This is the Reading Envy Podcast, where we'll have what you're reading.
Hi, I'm Jenny, and I'm settling down at the Reading Envy Pub with a cup of coconut chai, and I have someone with me who we haven't heard from for a while.
Hello.
But I think you'll recognize him.
Hi, Scott. Hey, how are you?
It's Tammy? Scott. He's back.
I'm back. Yes, I've been under the table the entire time. I've enjoyed all of your conversations. Yes, work travel has got the best of me. It's cut into the precious reading time and the recording time both. But someday I'll wrestle this to the ground.
Yeah. Well, I'm always glad to have you back on.
Well, thank you very, very much. I love being here. And I brought books. I brought three of them.
You've had some time to read.
Yes, I have. Should I start?
Sure, if you want.
Okay. Well, this book is one that I went back and forth on whether to or not to talk about it, but I think it's interesting. So I'm going to talk about it at the risk of... I have a lot of Mormon friends, and this book is perceived by some as being negative towards Mormons. Yet it is written by a Mormon woman. Her name is Mehdi Ivy Harrison, and the book is called The Bishop's Wife. And what it is, in a nutshell, is a murder mystery set in a Mormon community. So it's not giving anything away to say that the murdered person is Mormon and the murderer is Mormon, when it's all said and done. So, but it's one of the few, not that I've read a ton of Mormon books, so I can't even say that. So I'm just going to, I just want to tread carefully because I read the book and I thought it was interesting for a couple of reasons, but one of them was, I didn't feel any kind of an overwhelming negativity. The main character's name is Linda Walheim, and she is a bishop's wife from the title, and she's the one who is doing the sleuthing in the novel. She doesn't work as a private eye or anything like that. She just starts looking into things. As the bishop's wife, she has a certain position in the community. And that's all described in the book, and I think people would find that really interesting. And anyway, I haven't read another book like it, so that's why I decided to go ahead and talk about it. I wanted to read, at the very end, there's acknowledgments. And I thought this was really interesting. It says that... She met, okay, so they acknowledge, I'd like to thank Juliet Graves for taking a chance on this book. We met serendipitously at Sirens Conference in Vail, Colorado in October of 2010, and she asked me to send her something if I ever wrote something she could publish. Over the next few years, I sent her several things, but none of them were right for Soho. Soho is the name of the imprint. It's Soho Crime. So it's not an LDS publisher. Even when I sent her The Bishop's Wife in January of 2013, I was merely asking for her opinion, not imagining she could publish the book. After all, Soho Crime mostly specialized in international crime stories. When she offered publication on that first read, I was stunned, happy, confused, nervous, and a whole host of other emotions. I asked her how she could publish a book set in this small town, Utah, that was not international, and she said... It's like Mormons are a different country. They speak a different language, and you're the interpreter. So I thought that was really interesting. And Soho has a website, and I looked at it, and there is a map there that kind of shows where their mysteries are set. And sure enough, there's a little X right on Utah. I thought that was interesting. So with that in mind, when I first started to read the book, I was turned off by it. Because I didn't know that the acknowledgments are at the very end. And I'll read a little part here. But I felt that the character was thinking thoughts that she wouldn't really think. It was almost as if you were watching a movie in which the main character would stop and say, you know, we Mormons do this, and then would continue on, you know?
Oh, and lots of telling.
Yeah, so there's a whole lot of telling, but the telling pretty much stops about 20% into the book, I felt. So I'm going to read just a little bit from the very first chapter. And what happens, the very first thing that occurs in the book is you have a Mormon bishop and his wife in their home, and they've got, I think it was only one kid left in their home. The kid was upper high school. The rest of their kids had moved on. And so the bishop, for those who don't know, a Mormon bishop is like a priest for the ward. Okay, a ward is a collective, you know, I use, you know, Catholic terms, you know, like diocese and community and things like, and parish.
It's regional grouping.
It is. It's a regional grouping of people, and each one has one bishop, and the bishop is who would run the services every Sunday. He actually has two assistants, and these people are all, this is not their job. This is their second job. So, you know, you'll work 40 hours a week at your regular job, but you're also the bishop and you do that and you do it for no money at all. So, the person is given two assistants to, they're called counselors and they can fill in for him, you know? So they work as a team, but the bishop is in charge. And the bishop's wife, you know, in the LDS church, you know, a woman can't be a bishop. So the bishop's wife has like an unofficial function. She's like the mother of the ward. People constantly look to her, even though it's not an official stated position that this person is that. It's what happens all the time. And I've seen it myself over and over. You know, I've lived for a long time, you know, hell, my whole life in LDS communities. So what happens here is one of the ward members comes to the house. It's very early in the morning. The bishop is still up in the shower, and he's got his daughter with him. And he is obviously in a lot of distress. And he doesn't tell the bishop's wife what's going on. He just comes in, and he sits down, and he has his daughter there. And Jared is the name of the man. So she says, last week in Sunday school, with Jared sitting beside her, Carrie, who is his wife, had made a comment about the priesthood not belonging to men, but rather being God's power that men had access to. Jared's expression was livid. He'd leaned over and whispered something to her, and after that I saw her flinch when he tried to touch her. 4 days later, and apparently Jared Helm had still not apologized to her sufficiently. And she was making that conclusion based on the fact that his wife was not there. And now he sat here crying silently in the hall at 6:50 on a Thursday morning. Are you hungry? I asked. I can get you something to eat. And the I is the bishop's wife. And then here's your aside. Food is the first thing we Mormons tend to offer. Sometimes it helps and sometimes it doesn't. But the offer is a way of showing concern at least. No, thank you, said Jared, clearing his throat. I'm fine. I'm hungry, said Kelly, who's the girl, taking her thumb out of her mouth. You don't need to eat again. I already fed you breakfast at home. Kelly looked at her thumb and said nothing. Growing children are always hungry, I said. I don't mind fixing her something. It will make me feel useful. I put Kelly down, covering up the hand with a damp thumb as I led her into the kitchen. Behave yourself, Kelly, said Jared. I wasn't sure if he was always like this with her or if he was simply overly anxious about being in someone else's home. I hoped it was the latter and could show him that I didn't mind the trouble. So that's kind of what it's like. So once, you know, I found it interesting, even those asides, even though they felt out of place, it was almost like, you know, reading a science fiction novel in which they stopped to explain stuff constantly. And she would, if you're interested in the Mormon faith, it's very interesting because what you're seeing here is not all of the doctrine and everything. What you're seeing here is what it's like to be a Mormon, which is something that I haven't seen very often, except in books that are written where, you know, with a kind of a whitewash, you know, and I haven't read anything near all the LDS books that are out there. So if anybody has examples, I would love to put them in comments or whatever. But
like characters in literature aren't often LDS.
Yes.
I can't think of a single one.
Okay. Yeah.
Unless it'd be like an inspirational mm-hmm. fiction, right? Which is what they usually call the religious published stuff.
Exactly. Exactly. Now, where does the controversy come in? Well, the controversy comes in because of the things that this woman has to say. She's a bishop's wife. And Mehdi Ivy Harrison, like I said, the author of the book, is a Mormon woman. And this woman, one of the things that's happened in her past is she lost a child, in childbirth. And it was a girl. It would have been her first girl. And Mormons have a doctrine that says that, your family will all be together in heaven. It's like an eternal marriage. And then you have this guy here who comes and, she's suspecting that some type of foul play has happened, very quickly. She's like, well, why is he here? Where is his wife? He's saying at the beginning of the book that she ran away. She's thinking, did he really run away? I know that he's kind of a volatile guy. Here I am thinking, maybe he's done something to her. And then she would think about what that means to her as a Mormon in that, well, does that mean their family's still together if something like that were to happen? And, what about my daughter who died? Where does she fit into this? She has thoughts, and I'm just using that as an example. She is not a rank and file, stay in line, don't ask any questions type of a Mormon. She is, in a way, I guess you could say, well, I was going to use the word feminist, but I don't know if that's really accurate. It's not like she was demanding.
Thinker?
Yeah, a critical thinker. That's really it. I don't want to imply that, she was using the book to try and, get women the priesthood or something like that. She wasn't on any soapboxes trying to say that I wish the church was this, but she is a critical thinker. She's very smart and she has questions and things bother her like things do in, religions, right?
Sure.
And I think that some of that has caused her a little bit of backlash, the author. But still, I read it. When I was done with it, I didn't think it was horrible. I don't know. I didn't feel like it was negative. I read a lot of things in there that I've talked to people about and I know that they were, concerned about and think about and wonder about this and that. And there's a lot of that stuff in there. So it was a
Seems
really
fair.
Interesting cultural look at the Mormon faith.
Was it a good crime story too?
Yeah, it wasn't bad. Again, I was talking to somebody not too long ago about mystery stories, and the mystery is rarely the most important thing to me in a mystery novel, if you can believe that. It's like, I can't think of a lot of mystery novels where I was just completely taken by the mystery, and the thing that kept me moving on was the resolution of that mystery. Even though that's what mystery novels are, when I read one like James Lee Burke or something like that, or Craig Johnson, or like this one, what I'm interested in is all the people and their reactions to everything. It's like, if I knew what the resolution of this novel was, I'd still read it. Is that odd of me? Maybe it is, but
no, I mean, I used to, if I ever read a crime or mystery novel, it's usually because of the setting or the people.
Yeah.
Like I read this series of, kind of like archaeological mysteries that were set in Ireland and they always had to do with bog bodies.
Mm-hmm.
But I just like the setting so much.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So I just read everything I could find. And then I remember reading a series that was all set in different national parks.
Very nice.
So I'm a big settings person, I guess.
Yeah, and that's really what's interesting about it. And often mm-hmm. it's the main character. When you read a whole series of them, which this is going to be the beginning, it's called a Linda Walheim mystery. So she's writing more of these. And this bishop's
wife.
Do you
think you'll read them?
Yeah, I think I will. I was interested enough to do it. And it's kind of neat. You know, I live around here, and it was set in Draper, Utah, which is just south of Salt Lake City. It's a place I go to. So
yeah, sounds like it's familiar.
Exactly. So it's kind of neat to read that and say, oh, I know that place. And oh, she got that totally wrong. Why? What's wrong with her? You know, but it's neat. I thought it was good. I enjoyed it. And the mystery was good. Yeah, I guess, you know, I can't really say more about it without spoiling it, but I liked it.
Yeah, it sounds a little different from the other stuff that you read.
It is, yeah.
Nice to have some variety.
It is. Yeah, she's local. You know, I've met her a few times. She wrote, this isn't her first novel, she wrote YA fiction. And it was interesting that she said, you know, she was struggling around in YA fiction. She wrote something called Mira Mirror. And then she was writing some fairy tale rewritings that were pretty well received. And I think they were being published by Harper or something like that. And then she kind of had some kind of a publishing snafu, you know, with that, you know, economic downturn and everything, you know, things happen strangely. But she said that then she was writing these novels. And she said, you know, I feel like I was the only one who could write this one. I felt like, you know, anybody could have written other ones. You know, and I thought that was an interesting statement. She was like, you know, I'm in this one. And maybe in this character or something. And the other one, you know, she wasn't really in that one. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I thought I liked her quite a bit. I like her. Yeah. But I will read more because it was good enough for me to do that, and I will.
Yeah.
Whatever the next one may be, you bet. So that's all I've got on that one. So did I implicate if anybody who is Mormon has read this, I would love to hear from you. I really would. So
yeah, and it sounds like maybe she just, you know, maybe she's not using it as a, it's not a tool to get people to become Mormons. She's just trying to represent what being a Mormon is like.
She is not trying to get people to be Mormon, and she's not trying to get Mormons not to be. I mean, absolutely neither direction. She is presenting.
And I would think that in any religious
real
community, there'd be like a range of how people behave,
and that's exactly how people are. You know.
Yeah.
So.
It's hard to be offended by that.
It is.
Unless you're looking for it.
I could see how people would look at that. You know, and I've read books that, you know, make me roll my eyes as a Christian, you know, where you're like, oh, come on. You know, here we see this again. You know, where you know, we're attacked in a certain way, you know, in a particular way, always poked, you know what I mean? And when you start to see it over and over, you just start to roll your eyes. But I think this book is new in the LDS community. So, I mean, I just think that, they should welcome it. They should welcome that this isn't from an LDS publisher. It's not an attack. It's going to be the first of probably many LDS characters that are going to be in mainstream fiction. And they should welcome that, I think. And probably most people do. You know, whenever there is a controversy, it does not mean that 90% of LDS people are angry. You know, it could be a very, very small group of people. It's just that, you know, when I picked it up, I didn't even know there was any. So.
Yeah. Well, and in general, like, for instance, the Book of Mormon musical, which I know we've both seen.
Yes.
Well, the Mormon Church handled that well.
They really did, didn't they? They didn't sit there and fight it. Yeah. I remember in my program, there was an ad for the Mormon Church.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We agree this book will change your life. Come read it.
Exactly. Exactly right. And that's kind of neat, you know? Mm-hmm. Well done.
Yeah, that's fine.
I thought it was good. So what have you got?
Well, it's another kind of religious themed book. So this book doesn't come out for another few weeks, but I just can't stop thinking about it since I read it. And I get a lot of review copies of books, and I try to stay away from brand new books most of the time, but this time, here it is. It's called The Anchoress by Robin Cadwalader. I think I'm saying her name right, but I'm not sure. Do you know what an anchoress is?
An anchoress? I must not, because nothing's leaping to mind. What is an anchoress? Okay. Someone who who gives us the news. No, an anchoress is a woman who chooses to withdraw from the world to live a solitary life of prayer and mortification. Is that right?
Yeah, that is right. And so that's what this book is about. It's a woman named Sarah. She's the daughter of a cloth merchant, and she wants to commit her life to God. And so she goes through ceremony. I mean, it's similar to becoming a nun, only you're basically nailed into a cell.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone else has to take care of you. Everyone else is responsible for your food and your bodily needs and your spiritual needs. And you become almost practically a part of the church in that village or that town. And I had heard of people like, you know, Hildegard of Bingen and people like that who had withdrawn. I didn't realize, I guess, to the extent that what that means, like no sunlight, no fresh air. And I also had really no sense of what that person's place in the community was. I always thought that if you made yourself into that kind of character, like that, it was just you and your thoughts or you and your prayers. And, you know, that was it. And the interesting thing about this novel is that she has very little time to herself, actually, because she has a maid and kind of like an assistant to the maid, and she has a priest that comes and visits her every week. And there's a former anchoress who died in the cell, and her bones were buried under the dirt right there where she's also sleeping. And she has conversations with her sometimes, and people come to her for advice, particularly women. There's a wealthy man who wanted to marry her, and he comes and visits her even though he's not supposed to. So it's very interesting, and she resists the contact quite a bit. She wants to be separate, but she's not really allowed to be separate. She's reliant on the people of the town, you know, to support her. So there's this kind of sense that she has to give things back. I don't know. It was just fascinating to try to imagine that kind of life.
That is fascinating.
Yeah. And, you know, back then, becoming a nun or an anchoress or something, in some ways, that was maybe, I mean, we're talking about the word feminist. Is that being a feminist or not? Mm-hmm. But choosing something other than the standard expectation of wife and mother, really did take some doing. And she had a lot of resistance from her father, who wanted to make money from her marriage, and just from other people. Of course, the man she wanted to marry was resistant to the idea of her not getting married. But it's interesting. So I was going to read a little part, and I should say this is from a galley, so
okay,
it might not be exactly like this in the final version, but it's coming out soon, so I imagine it's pretty close. And so I have to explain a few things. Number one, she has one book in there with her. It's called Her Rule, and it's basically kind of a handbook, maybe, for being an anchoress. And it's something that had to be hand copied just for her. And it comes from a specific line of anchoresses, and just kind of, it tells her what to do. And
does she get to add to it when she's old and wise?
I don't think so. I think it comes from the men.
Okay.
And it was chosen by the priest. I mean, yeah. So it's, you know, this is the Catholic Church. So, I'm not sure who wrote it originally, but I have the impression that it was, you know, kind of like an overseeing person.
Okay.
And it's kind of a comfort to her. So she looks to it for help. And the other thing that's important to know is that her sister Emma has recently died in childbirth. And that's kind of the final straw that sends her to this cell. So those things come up in what I'm going to read.
Sorry, I apologize if I missed it, but what's the time frame? Is this like medieval times?
I think
times
it's like the 13th.
Okay.
Yeah, like 12th or 13th century.
Okay.
That kind of era.
Interesting.
Okay, so here I go. Noises outside, shouting, laughter, squeals, and curses. It was All Hallows' Eve, and though I couldn't see the fires on the green just beyond the church, it seemed right that so soon after my enclosure I could pray for the dead, my dead. If I was to guide Anna as my rule required, I needed first to commit Emma to God. I moved to my altar and knelt to pray, saying the words once more, willing my heart to let go of memories of my sister. The squeak of metal close by, the sound of wood on wood as the church door shut, the smell of dirt floated into me as it always did when someone entered the church. Muffled footsteps, a few soft thumps, and then quietness. The cough of a sick man, dry and rasping, the sound of breath dragged in and out. Perhaps he had come to pray, grieving for a wife or a son or a brother. Ah, my page just turned. I moved to my altar, knelt to pray for him, asking Christ to ease that hollow pain of loss I understood. And I'm going to skip forward a little bit. A piercing screech, and I startled, looked around, came back to my dark cell. The smell of smoke, flickers of orange high on my wall, coming in through gaps in the thatch. Outside, the crackle of burning wood, screams of merriment, drumbeats, and bells. Children would be wearing masks, running, dancing, cackling, and whooping like monsters or ghosts, now shadow, now golden in the firelight. This year, on this night of the dead, there is no one with me to see or touch, no one to reassure me that I was alive. But I wasn't. My rule told me that I was dead to the world, that the cell was my grave. I looked around, wondered where they would dig the hole for my body. Agnes was here, just below my squint. Had they buried Isabella there as well? I guess I'll stop there.
Wow.
So she's basically, when she comes to this place, she's agreeing to live there until she dies.
That's amazing.
I don't know. It's not that I could do.
Yeah, I mean, she's sitting there just within reach of all that activity all the time. So it's not like she's a hermit where, you know, you're out in the woods and you can't see everyone else. You're right there. That's amazing.
Yeah, because it would almost be easier, wouldn't it? If you didn't smell the smells and hear the sounds.
You'd think so.
And have lived your life up to that point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I honestly don't know what would be easier, being out of it or being close to it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, and I've always been fascinated by people who are aesthetes. Is that what you say when they're like deny themselves things? And
yeah.
Yep. I don't know. It's just hard to imagine the life. Oh, and I guess the other thing I was going to say is that, you know, people tend to be very spiritual.
You said people can be very spiritual?
Well, I think most people that are drawn to this life are.
Right.
But I think this book, it kind of portrays that question of where's the line between spirituality and mental illness.
Oh.
I am not saying that people who are spiritually or mentally ill, but
sure.
In this particular case, you know, the only... I don't know, the only checkpoint she has are the random people that talk to her. So she's very much in her head and focused on these other things. And it's a little disturbing at times almost.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah,
and they actually have to kind of bring her back from place. Like, she goes too far. She takes too seriously. She stops eating and things like that.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm. So interesting book.
That is an interesting book. Is it uplifting or is it a downer? Or, I mean, how did you feel after you finished?
That's a good question. I don't know. I kind of felt like when it finishes, it's more like you're leaving them where they are. There are some good things that happen and some bad things that happen. I think that Sarah herself comes into a place where she's more even with it. Like, after she's been in there a year, there are some things that happen near the end that make it a little more tolerable for her, but it's kind of her learning how to be there too,
yeah,
that you're witnessing.
Wow. So. Well, great. That sounds like something I would really, really like to read.
Yeah.
So put it on my list.
Wow.
What I did for Lent is completely inadequate. I'm going to build myself a little shed.
And you have to hang up a curtain so people can't see you.
All right. All right. Well, cool. Neat. Yeah, that's a cool. That sounds good. The second thing that I brought is a novella called Annabelle Scheme by Robin Sloan. Have you read this one? Does it sound familiar to you? Okay. Robin Sloan is the guy who wrote Mr. Penumbra's 24-Hour Bookstore, which I read recently and really liked. Now, this one, I believe, was written before that. And after I finished it, I started to poke around, and I found out that it was actually financed by a Kickstarter. In fact, I'm looking at the Kickstarter right now, and he got $13,942, and he was asking for $3,500. So I immediately started my own Kickstarter. Not really.
Seriously.
Seriously. I'm just like, wow, how fantastic. But yeah, and this Kickstarter that I'm looking at was, I think it was 2009, and the book came out in 2010. I may be incorrect how it turned out, but it looks like the people that donated in the Kickstarter may have gotten hard copies. And as far as I know, there's not hard copies for sale. It's a Kindle thing. But I read it purely because I enjoyed Mr. Penumbra's 24-Hour Bookstore, which had a lot of Google stuff in it. And have you read that one? Have you read Mr. Penumbra's? Okay. So there's
yes,
a lot of, okay. So there's a lot of Google stuff in there, and the stuff that I really liked, and there was kind of a puzzle. Anyway, I enjoyed the novel. I thought it was very entertaining. So Annabelle Scheme is about, I hesitate because it's just like, you know, well, it's about a lot of things. Let's see. There's just a lot of stuff in here. So it's like Sherlock and Watson, but Sherlock is a female and Watson is an artificial intelligence. There are ghosts and demons and angels. There's an online game called The World of Jesus, and which is a lot like Second Life, but it's the World of Jesus. So you're walking around in, you know, Jerusalem and stuff. And there are quantum computers that mess up the physical laws in San Francisco. So there are some places where gravity doesn't work right. And there's a section of San Francisco that is permanently in a fog, but once you go in this fog, it, you know, whatever happens in there, you know, it could be anything. And there also is a Google in Annabelle Scheme, but they call it Grail. So the Watson character, who is the he actually serves the purpose of Watson and Sherlock and Watson. If you think Watson is the main character in those stories, then Watson's the main character in this one too, because he's the one who's telling the story. And I say he, but it's an artificial intelligence. So, I mean, I'm listing so many cool things, but it's a novella. So if you can imagine that it felt a little cramped to me and like there was a little bit too much, that's the way that I felt, but I still enjoyed it. You know, when I was reading it, there was just a lot of really neat stuff. You know, it was almost like there was kind of snow crashy Sherlock and Watson, maybe Edgar Allan Poe, you know, all this stuff kind of mashed together into one thing. And I think it would be, if this was a novel, I think it would be better. It was just, you know what I'm trying to say? Just, you know, everything I can get in here, I'm going to put in here. And it sort of gets a little chaotic at times, I felt. But again, I really enjoyed it, and the whole story about the AI was really neat. The Google again is called Grail. It's a company called Grail, and they had all these computers, and then all of a sudden, all those computers stopped doing stuff, and quantum computers started doing stuff. So there was all these computers that used to be doing stuff that were, you know, basically super duper computers that now are no longer doing anything. And this Annabelle scheme bought one for her business, right? And she was getting ready to upload a operating system to it. And it said, excuse me, I'm perfectly capable of acting as a server. What are your needs? And she was like, I would like an assistant. You know, so from then on, he's like always in her ear, which to me is just cool. I really like, I know it's been in other books, but I just love it. I'm going to read just the beginning, if that's all right. The first chapter is called Zeroth Avenue. And if I read this, it'll give you a really good flavor without giving anything away. So it starts, where the skinny green strip of the panhandle rolled into the basin of Golden Gate Park, there was a row of old Edwardians on a short stub of a street called Zeroth Avenue. Their shapes were all the same, each with jutting orioles and a deep-set doorway, like eyes and a mouth, but each was painted with a different palette, blue and white, green and gold, brown and slightly darker brown. The house on the corner was monochrome and asymmetrical, every slat and shingle a different shade of gray. From across the street, it looked like static. The sign on the front door said, Annabelle Scheme, Investigator, Digital, and Occult. But I didn't know which part of the business our visitor had come for. It was my first case with Scheme. I was hoping for Occult. Inside, the blinds were tilted down against the sun. Our visitor was young, late 20s, with dark freckles and smudges of makeup around his eyes. He was wearing a black hoodie and flip-flops, sitting up straight in Scheme's blue chair, reserved for clients. His name was Ryan Kelly. He had a bruise spreading on his cheek. They're everywhere, Ryan Kelly was saying. They've got my voice on them, singing stuff I never sang. Scheme sat across from him at her narrow desk piled high with paper. Her hair was down in coppery curls around her shoulders, and she looked tired. You're a professional musician, she said. I'm in a band, he said. His voice was hoarse. We played a show last night. How did it go? It sucked. His band is called Moon Suicide, I whispered to Scheme. I figured a detective's assistant was always whispering tips in her ear. Popular, but not that popular. Is it like a hacker? Ryan asked. It's bullshit. Scheme nodded. Sounds like a musical imposter. I think you need a copyright lawyer, not a detective. I know someone. I found you on Grail, Ryan said. Emphasis on you. You must have been searching for something strange. He looked down at his flip-flops. There's another voice on the tracks. Scheme was silent, waiting. I used to be in a different band. 6 years ago, it was just the two of us. Her name was Pam Pryor. She was my girlfriend. It's her voice, too. What does she think of this? She's dead. I'm sorry to hear that, Scheme said. So these are old recordings? Somebody got their hands on them. Ryan shook his head. The lyrics are about stuff that happened after she died. All this crazy shit in Fog City. He's right. I found the tracks. The band is called Pam and Ryan, and they're very topical. They featured on the biggest music filter, The Listener. And that was the AI, it's all in italics, talking to Annabelle Scheme. And so the AI is happy that it's a cult. and that's the opening of it. And I was captured by that and read eagerly the rest of the way. But
yeah, I need to tell my book club that read Mr. Penumbra's about this because I don't think they know about it.
Yeah.
They'll be excited.
That's cool. And I didn't know about it either. So again, it's got some computer stuff. It's got some occult stuff. It's got some Sherlock stuff. It's crazy.
Does it fit into Penumbra's world somehow?
No. I would say okay. No, because...
So it's not related.
No, because, you know, even though it was in San Francisco, Mr. Penumbra, it, you know, it was Google in Mr. Penumbra. So here it's a That's fake true. Company called Grail, and there's really strange occultish stuff going on. And, you know, in Mr. Penumbra, there really wasn't that occult stuff. It was an interesting puzzle. It was odd, but
yeah,
this is really odd. Ghosts and World of Jesus made me laugh. I mean, that was pretty funny. They went in there because they needed to talk to a suspect, right? So they're chasing down this whole thing. You know, how can a dead person be on these tracks? And, you know, they're learning all kinds of stuff, like, you know, how easy would it be to put a dead person's voice on tracks, you know, if you have all the computing power in the world, you know, that's actually not occultish at all. And then, so anyway, but it's like World of Warcraft, but you have an avatar and you go out there. It says in there something like, you know, they saw Mary come walking down the street, right? And there was angels around her. And they said, that has to be the program, because if you're in World of Jesus, you don't get to be Mary. You have to be like a peasant. You don't get to be John or right. Jesus or anybody like that. You're going to be it just made me laugh the whole way it was put. So
that sounds really funny.
It was fun. So it's a fun short read. It's a novella. So I think Amazon tells you that the page count, I can't remember what it said, the page, I don't have it in front of me anymore, but, not a long book, but it was cool. Enjoyable read. I think that he should pursue that. I would take these characters and then start from scratch. I wouldn't try to expand this. I would say, all right, let me do this again as a novel. And, I bet you it would be really good. That's what I would do.
Yeah.
So it's kind of up your alley, a little cyberpunky.
Yeah, it sounds like it.
Yep. You bet. So what's number two on your list?
Well, yesterday, from the day that we're recording, not from the day this will post, but I actually got to go down and see George Saunders speak at an event in Columbia called the Open
Southern
Book.
Southern writer George Saunders.
Southern writer.
He's not Southern? I thought he was a Southern writer.
No.
Okay, I apologize then.
There's another guy named George that writes short stories that is Southern. That would be... What is his last name? Oh, no. Another George. Anyway, George Saunders, his book, just 10th of December, it's a book of short stories. It was a finalist for the National Book Award. It was one of the 10 best books on the New York Times Book Review for 2013. And according to him last night, it's the first book he's gotten royalties from. I think that was probably a joke, but
nice.
You know, who makes a living off of writing short stories? Well, he doesn't really either. He works in the MFA program at Syracuse. So I had listened to the audiobook of this 2 years ago. And so knowing I was going to go see him speak, I reread the print. And I thought I'd talk about it a little bit because, you know, part of it's in my head because of hearing him talk about writing. And then part of it's just enjoying the stories. I wanted to edit in a recording of him reading it because he does the entire audiobook for this and has this really strong Chicago accent and he does voices for some of the characters and it's really, really fabulous.
3 days shy of her 15th birthday, Allison Pope paused at the top of the stairs. Say the staircase was marble. Say she descended and all heads turned. Where was Special One? Approaching now, bowing slightly, he exclaimed, "How can so much grace be contained in one small package?" Oops. Had he said small package? And just stood there? Broad prince-like face, totally bland of expression? Poor thing. Sorry, no way. Down he went. He was definitely not Special One. What about this guy, behind Mr. Small Package, standing near the home entertainment center, with a thick neck of farmer integrity yet tender, ample lips, who, placing one hand on the small of her back, whispered, "Dreadfully sorry you had to endure that bit about the small package just now. Let us go stand on the moon. Or in the moon, in the moonlight." Had he said, "Let us go stand on the moon"? If so, she would have to be like, eyebrows up. And if no wry acknowledgement was forthcoming, be like, I am not exactly dressed for standing on the moon, which, as I understand it, is super cold. Come on, guys, she couldn't keep treading gracefully on this marble stairwell in her mind forever. That dear old white hair in the tiara was getting all like, why are those supposed princes making that darling girl march in place ad nausea? Plus, she had a recital tonight and had to go fetch her tights from the dryer. Egads, one found oneself still standing at the top of the stairs. Do the thing where, facing upstairs, hand on railing, you hop down the stairs one at a time, which was getting a lot harder lately, due to someone's feet were getting longer every day, seemed like. Pas-de-chat, pas-de-chat, chansement, chansement. Hop over thin metal thingy separating hallway tile from living room rug. Curtsy to self in entryway mirror. Come on, Mom, get here. We do not wish to be castrated by Ms. Callow again in the wings. Although, actually, she loved Ms. C. So strict. Also loved the other girls in class. And the girls from school. Loved them. Everyone was so nice. Plus the boys at her school. Plus the teachers at her school. All of them were doing their best. Actually, she loved her whole town. That adorable grocer spraying his lettuce. Pastor Carol with her large, comfortable butt. The chubby postman gesticulating with his padded envelopes. It had once been a mill town. Wasn't that crazy? What did that even mean?
So you can hear this young person.
Very well read.
In there. Yeah.
I like
it. It's so great. And his accent, you have to hear him read it. Uh-huh. And so this story, he gets accused of being dark and he claims it's not on purpose. It just happens. Mm-hmm. So the story starts out with this girl kind of dancing around her house and practicing her French. And then she gets abducted and the boy across the street has to do something. So.
Oh, wow. Nice.
Yeah. And then there's another story in here that's crazy about like if our drugs were just a little bit better than they are now and like how much control you have over yourself and how much of it is chemical. And there are these people that are put into situations based on the drugs that they have and they're studied that way. So wow. A lot of people were talking about that story last night. It's called, Escape from Spiderhead.
Wow.
So the place is Spiderhead.
Cool. Well, that sounds like something I'd like too. And what was the, did you say that the one that you have in your hand there was his first one or his most recent one?
This is his most recent.
Okay.
He has written quite a few books, eight books. And my other favorite of his is his first one, Pastoralia.
Pastoralia. Okay.
Yeah. So I have read several over the years.
Wow.
And they're just all the stories are very distinct and memorable.
Cool.
Which I like. And short stories are hard, right? I mean, I think they're hard.
Yeah. Yeah.
To always, you know, connect with every story in a book or something like that.
Sure. But. Sure. Yeah. My trouble with short stories is I can't read them back to back. Like I need a little space in between the two. I can't finish one and start the next. So that's what makes them hard for me. But yeah, I do enjoy them.
They're
though.
So dense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the good ones are.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. Yep. Like, James Tiptree Jr.
Yeah. And well, and George Saunders last night was talking a lot about, cutting out all the fluffy stuff, you know, all the unnecessary parts. And so it was interesting to hear him talk about that and then to reread some of the stories with that in mind, you know, to see if that's what he does. I think he does it quite well.
Absolute minimum needed. That's cool.
Yeah.
Very nice.
Yeah, so that was good.
I like it. Well, thank you.
Sure. Oh, what about
you? I've got one more, yeah. I've got to reach over here to get it. Oh, here it is. Sorry, I left it just out of reach. I read this book because I do a youth group at the library once a month. And I try to read something for the group once a month. You know, we don't all do a group read, but I usually have the kids just pick one. And anyway, I don't have one currently. We didn't pick one this last time around. But anyway, this one that I read is called Fable Haven by Brandon Mull. And anyway, it was interesting. You know, I spent the first half of it just kind of like, you know, but then it ended really well. So I've got a positive view of it, and the kids absolutely love it. You know, Brandon Mull is someone who I've heard about this book so much that, you know, it felt like I had read it before I read it, even though I didn't really know exactly what it was about, but what it's about is, it's kind of a magical place story. There's there's a magical place where a whole bunch of magical creatures live, and it's a haven for them so that they don't get destroyed. And the two kids that are the main characters, Kendra and Seth, who are brother and sister, they, you know, like happens in YA books, most of the time you got to get rid of the parents somehow. So the parents drop them off at their grandparents' house while they went on a vacation. And so they had 2 weeks at this house, and their grandpa was the only one at the house when they got dropped off. And they had no idea where the grandmother went. But it turns out that the grandfather is kind of the caretaker of this place. And there's a lot of mystery going on. You know, the kids get a room with all these toys, not unlike... Well, it had the flavor of a Narnia story a little bit. Not that those kids had toys. I mean, they were kind of like making up their own stuff to do in Narnia. But in this one, you know, the grandpa gave him a few keys and said, see if you can figure out what these go to. And anyway, what they ended up seeing is like dragonflies and other normal creatures. As soon as they drank some of this special milk, they could see them as what they were, which were mystical creatures. And then the main problem of the book is that there was a demon that was going to wake up and cause havoc, basically destroy the haven, and they had to stop it at all costs. So, and it ended well, you know, Kendra ended up by herself for a good part of the end of the book. And that was some really interesting, really good stuff, that he did there, with her, I thought. So that's a book. I don't know if I should read some. It's a YA novel. Mandatory Vacation. I really didn't pick out a specific thing to read on this.
I
probably should have, but anyway, overall it's a YA book, and it's, you know, the most interesting thing is that once I read one of these, to go and use it as a springboard to talk to the kids about something. And what I used it for was to talk to them about just magic in books. And what that does is it pulls them into the conversation. You know, I was like, okay, you have all kinds of different magic. You have books with magical places, for example. Name me some books with magical places. And then that opens them up and they start to talk about stuff. And that's when it becomes fun.
Yeah.
When they start saying, oh yeah, what about this book, you know? Turns out that Harry Potter, yeah, well, Harry Potter is the one that comes up the most often because it fit every single category. It's like, you know, every little, you know, you have magical items, they're in there. There's, you know, well, potion to be like a magical item. If you have sorcery, you know, we talked about the cost of magic, how, you know, if you have a magic system that has no cost, it wouldn't really be good for a story. Mm-hmm. You know, so we started talking the books that they mentioned. What, you know, what the costs were, but by far Harry Potter is still the most popular thing. It's like the common thing. You can walk into, you know, a typical group of kids and say Harry Potter, and they all know what it is, and they've all read it.
Yeah, college students too.
Yeah,
there is a Quidditch team at the university where I work.
That's amazing.
And they compete with other Quidditch teams at other universities.
Oh, jeez.
So it's not like a one place thing.
That I don't know what to think about that. I hope they have a good time. I hope it's fun.
Yeah, it's fun.
You know, and there's something that made me feel old, and you know, this is about to change because Disney's taking care of it. But to go in there and have a group of 9, 10, 11, 12 year old kids and say the word Star Wars and have half of them look at you like, what is that? Is really, really odd. Yeah. And I know that you only recently watched them all. And
all in one weekend.
Yeah, that was so cool. But, you know, I'm saying, you know, like in Star Wars, when this happened and everybody's looking at you and I'm going, really? You know, so I've lost some of my references. But you know what the best thing? Well, I think I might have talked about this already on the podcast. I was just going to say if you're talking to a group, one of the best things I ever did was with your help. You gave me this thing that was like, if you like this book, then look at this one. It was called Novel List. Mm-hmm. And that was a really good day. having the kids look through that. I mean, the library even ordered some of the stuff that we found that they were interested in. And
Oh, that's great.
It was very lively. Yeah, it was neat. And then the other thing is to go through.
I use that myself sometimes.
Do you? Yeah. It just opens things up. When you have some point of commonality, I think is when you start to get activity. Another thing was the Newbery list. To go through the Newbery list and determine what people have read. A lot of kids have read a lot of them. And it's a pretty long list. So, you know, a lot of them means, you know, three or four. But when you can find that to connect with them too, I think it's fun. So since I've started this group in this particular round, because I had a couple years where I didn't do it, but I've read Island of the Blue Dolphins off the Newbery list, and then Ivan, what was it? What was that Ivan book called? I know I talked about it on this podcast, but you know, the one about
the
gorilla.
I want to say Ivan the Terrible, but that doesn't make sense.
Yeah. It's something, the Great Ivan or something like that. I'm going to have to look
by
it up
Catherine
here.
Somebody.
Yeah. Ivan Newbery comes right up. The one and only Ivan. That's what it is. Yeah. Which was a really good
Catherine.
Book. Catherine Applegate. Gotcha. Yep.
I also looked up the Southern author named George.
Yes.
We've met several times. I can't believe I can't remember his last name. Mm-hmm. Singleton.
That's right. I have a book of his on my shelf over here that I need to get read. I need to immerse myself in Southern literature to see what it does to me.
Yes, and one of the quotes that I see when I look his name up just on the first page of Hits is that they call him the unchallenged king of the comic Southern short story. So nice. They're a lot of fun to read.
Excellent. Excellent. So that's all I have. So Fablehaven, fun book, YA, kids love it.
Is it part of a series or is it standalone?
It's the first of five. It is standalone. Oh. It's just because it's the first one. But he wrote five and the kids told me that it's complete. So five and done is the expectation and he's moved on to other things. He does different series now. So
I've never heard of it until you talked about it. So
really?
I
assumed it was big everywhere, but I think Brandon Mull is a local writer, although, you know, I've never met him or anything, but this is not like an LDS imprint or anything like that. I said that before, just to be clear, there's several small presses that do things primarily for a Mormon audience. It's actually, you know, it's really big around here. But that's not what this one is. This one's Aladdin, New York, London, Toronto, Sydney.
Oh, yeah. And just because I don't know about it doesn't mean it's not national. I'm just not very tied into YA anymore. You know?
I'm pretty sure Brandon Mull is pretty well known amongst the kids anyway. And it was published in 2006, this first one. So it's been out for about 9 years.
Even with Harry
years.
Potter, I feel like I started around when book three came out, you know. So it took a while for it to cross my path, I guess.
Yeah, I did too. I remember seeing Harry Potter and going, I wonder what that's all about. And then I think you're right. It was right around book three is when it was my whole family really got involved and started. The really great memories. Book six and book seven, we went to midnight parties where the book was going to be sold at midnight and had a great time. And I was always, I lamented the fact that, you know, Sam's Club, or that's what it's called around here, Costco, would have pallets of these books. I felt like that was a betrayal to the bookstores. You know, I felt like they should sell the books at the bookstores because the bookstores had to sell all their other stuff. You know, why not give them the boon of selling the popular stuff?
The one thing they had.
Yeah. Instead, they gave it to the big box stores and I'm still bitter because our bookstore closed. We had a gorgeous Borders and it's gone. That's where we went for that party and everything, and that was fun. Really, really fun memories. So, but anyway, I'm done lamenting. What's your third book?
Well, we're not going to apologize for the books that we pick for this podcast. I feel like we've been doing that all the whole time, but this one is probably potentially the most offensive of the books that we've brought. So,
sweet. Offensive.
Yeah, I think that offensive is okay because a lot of times that happens because someone's writing from their unique perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And not everyone's going to agree with your perspective, but if you don't write your own perspective, who's going to, right?
Right. That's true. That's true.
So, yeah, fair warning for anyone, but I've tried to pick well, and I'll explain. But, you know, by the time this episode posts, it's going to be National Poetry Month again.
Mm-hmm.
Happy National Poetry Month.
Yes, you too.
So I was looking through some of the books I had marked as to read for poetry for the year, because I like read Publishers Weekly and I'm like, oh, that one sounds good. And I'm like, but I'm going to save it. And I save it for April. So this one is called They Don't Kill You Because They're Hungry, They Kill You Because They're Full by Mark Bibbins. So for one, it's a great title.
Yeah.
And it's very contemporary poetry. It's very much a reflection on the state of the world and how people treat each other. And they're all different styles. Some of them are very, you know how poems look on the page, kind of like how they sound, you know, some are close together and some are really spread out and some are random. And there's actually one that's 5 pages of words that end with N-E-S-S. That's all it is. I will not be reading that one. the set that is probably the most potentially offensive, but also hilarious and insightful is called, it's actually a set of poems, I'm getting there, called Pat Robertson Transubstantiation Engine. And there's number 1 through 6. And like, oh, boy, I was laughing so hard when I read these, and then I had to read them to my husband, who does not actually care for poetry. But I was like, these have to be read out loud. So I really, really enjoyed this, and I'm going to read 3 different ones if that's okay.
Of course.
Cause it's hard to talk about it. It's probably easier to just read it, to get kind of a sense. And it's very clear. I mean, I know a lot of poetry is, about words, but I think that Mark Bibbins really loves the sound of words. And mm-hmm. I think you can tell by how he writes. So this one is called Unity, Utility, Ubiquity.
Ready. And, I'm ready.
It actually mentions Mormons, too.
How about that? All right. This is the
if
Mormon
you're going to carry, If you're going to carry your gorgeous head around in a sack, let it be this beige plastic one. Wait, that's no good. It even says as much on the bag, right there, next to the message about Jesus. What we learn from this is, faith first, safety second. The bag washed up on the beach, like some beautiful gift from an ocean that loves us back, so I thought it fitting to recruit it. What a load of damage these gulls love doing to loot we leave unattended as we work the water. Good for them and their sideways eyes, I say. Let's run ads on bags for their avian religion that calls it kosher to disinter and circumcise. Oh, and circumcise Mormons with their beaks. Unless it's rude to bring up faith again. I'll close the speech and start a cornfield. Then I'm going to burn down that cornfield and build a bank. I can swim to save my own life at least. Then swim back to whatever's left of you.
Alrighty.
So, yeah, you'd have to spend a few days pulling that one apart.
You bet.
Mormons with their beaks. I'm not sure I quite understand that one. I just thought it was funny that it had Mormons in it.
Yeah, that is hilarious.
Yeah. Sorry, Mormons. So I'm going to read Pat Robertson Transubstantiation Engine number 5. I don't have to be nice to the spirit of the Antichrist. But oh, the sweet caul fat of Falwell melting on my tongues like a heavenly lozenge in a blizzard of ash. Jerry, that's my feeling. It tastes like loot in a wallet he sat on all day, rich as a tobacco field in heaven. Jerry, that's my feeling. We'll pray for some miners and their parent companies, which is where the real action is. You know what I mean. Jerry, that's my feeling. Jesus was all for shareholder value, maximum returns, and when he comes back, I'll chain him to a machine that turns water into oil.
All right.
Yeah.
Yes.
So I guess it's coming from Pat's perspective, Pat Robertson's perspective. One of them talks about marijuana biscuits. One of them talks to, one just starts, Jimmy in jail and I don't care. Tammy crack up and I don't care. So you can see why I was just laughing.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. Oh, man. Okay, so enough of Pat. clearly, this poet does not care for Pat.
Yes. No Pat Robertson for him.
Yeah, and so this poet actually comes from the opposite perspective. Like, he's won several awards, like, Oh, the Lambda Award. He's won several of those. And he's funded by the Lannan Foundation, which you often hear that word. Okay, so the last one I'm going to read is Junior National Treasure Cemetery.
Okay.
And I don't know if I could tell you what it means. I just really like the words. In case you are promiscuous or merely forgetful, I've carved your name on half the trees of this burnt forest to help you find home. Whether you arrived umbilical or toothing through an egg, explore. I'm going to start over. I can't say words. Okay. In case you are promiscuous or merely forgetful, I've carved your name on half the trees of this burnt forest to help you find home. Whether you arrived umbilical or toothing through an egg, exploit your former form for the larger culture. Everywhere I smell scorched meat I would not have eaten, even if cooked perfectly. The stench grabs my throat and shakes. Bodies walk out of hospitals, emptying the nurses' tip jars as they go. Unless you're Edward Gorey, don't tell us too early that there's arsenic in the pudding. We're willing to pay extra for a little more suspense. And
well, I'm not positive I know what that was about on that one, but that's what poetry
that's
the is.
Fun.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Oh, cool.
And some of them are very sad, you know, like about things that could have been good and aren't, or there's even one about terrorism in here, and one about Joaquin Phoenix. If you write poetry, you can write about anything.
That's right. That's right. Joaquin Phoenix is worthy of poetry.
Yeah, it's very much like culturally relevant poetry, I guess.
Yeah.
Very much in the current present day.
Huh. That's cool. Indeed.
Well, so cool. I'm going to try to read some more poetry this month.
And all right.
See what else comes.
A poetry episode. Yeah. I guess we don't need its own episode, huh? I need to expand past Billy Collins, who I just never tire of. I can read Billy Collins forever, but I really haven't tried much more other than what Garrison Keillor reads sometimes. Yeah. He has a big old set called Good Poems that I like.
Oh, are they good?
Yeah, they are very good. A lot of them.
Well, I kind of think that with poetry in particular, and probably everything you read, it's like you're going to have to, you have to be willing to work through some stuff that you don't like. I mean, not because you should read it, but because you have to try a whole bunch of things out before you connect with something. And I think poetry is so arbitrary. You know, style is all over the place, and what people are interested in writing about is all over the place. And it's not like there are genres for it, right?
Right, right.
So it always takes me a while to find stuff that I like in the piles, but I know it when I see it. Thank you for listening to the Reading Envy podcast.
You can find us at readingenvy.com.